Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
And we're back. Here we are, episode 298. Thank you so much for tuning in to the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I'm Sean Penrod, your host, ready to bring you another blast from the past, another best of episode. This time, it's with none other than Patrick Chapin. This is the first episode aired here on MTG Pro Tutor. And as I mentioned in the last episode, a little bit of the story is that when I started the podcast, I invited Patrick to be the first episode. He graciously said yes. I was so excited. Later that night, I actually met John Finkel and invited him onto the show as well. He said yes. I was like, sweet, this is great. So I booked an appointment with both of them, and it turns out that my interview with John Finkel was first. My interview with Patrick Chapin was next. But since I had already told Patrick I was going to put him as the first episode, then Patrick's episode came out first and John went out second. So this is actually the second interview I ever did. So another rough and raw Sean Penrod back in the day, more than 3 years ago, when I had less experience behind the microphone. So if you can bear with me, you're going to get some great stuff from Patrick. And Patrick has been on the show again since then, right? He was on the one-year anniversary show. But I think it's really cool to run back and hear his origin story and learn more about him. So that's why we're doing these best ofs, to hear from these great guests that we had in the past. Because I know with the show being over 3 years old, there are probably several of you prodigies who are newer listeners who have not gone back in the archives and heard these great interviews. So last week we did John Finkel. This week we're doing Patrick Chapin. And oh, another little tidbit from the past. Back in the day, I would do one interview and break it up into two parts. I'm not exactly sure why I did that. I think it's because, I don't even know, my reasonings back then just didn't make any sense. We now do one episode per interview, but back then I did two episodes per one interview. And anyway, so this is actually a really cool opportunity to put those segments back together so you can hear the entire interview in one go as opposed to going back and having to listen to two episodes with the same person. So anyways, so there's a little tidbit. That said, the show notes have been cleaned up. And again, instead of having to go to two different pages for the same content, you can just go to mtgpro2.com/Patrick Chapin best of, and that's where you'll find these show notes here. They'll be consolidated from before. So anyways, good stuff. I'm absolutely loving my trip here in Germany. Thank you so much for your patience and listening to the super raw Sean Penrod from back in the day and allowing me to run these best of episodes so I can sneak away with my wife for a few weeks. When I get back next week, though, I will be announcing the winner of the Patreon drawing for July. And that prize will, of course, be provided by Paragon City Games, proud sponsor of the show. You can find them over at ParagonCityGames.com, and I highly encourage you to look them up. And if you are a local in Utah, then go check them out. They have one of the best stores I've ever been in. Very clean, very friendly. The people there are great players and just good atmosphere, and it's just a really fun place to be. So definitely go and check them out, ParagonCityGames.com. And if you're local, head on up to the store in Draper. That said, we have a great guest lined up for you today. As you know, Patrick Chapin is a mainstay in Magic. He has his own podcast. He regularly makes it to the top of big events, and it's just a great guy to be around. So without further ado, let's bring in this blast from the past and learn from Patrick. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. Today, I am truly excited to kick things off with our featured guest. He is a Hall of Famer, Pro Tour champion, and five-time Pro Tour Top 8 competitor. Author of Next Level Magic and Next Level Deck Building, his articles can be found on StarCityGames.com, and his own podcast can be found at TopLevelPodcast.com. Today, we have none other than Patrick the Innovator Chapin. Patrick, how are you doing today?
Oh, fantastic. How are you doing, Sean?
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with our audience tips to take their game to the next level?
A daunting proposition, but I am excited to dive on in.
Sweet. So Patrick, I've shared a little bit about you, but we want to know you a little bit more personally. And so share what you have going on in your life.
I live out in Denver, Colorado right now, or at least my stuff is here. I'm here a fair bit, but I travel a great deal. I'm a professional Magic player, but I'm also a game designer, kind of just working a bazillion hours a week. I'm a game designer at Direwolf Digital here in Denver, and I write books about Magic, Next Level Magic, and Next Level Deck Building. You already hit on the podcast and various Magic stuff like that, but I guess I'm a professional Magic player who is involved in gaming a whole bunch and really relishes an opportunity to travel around the world playing Magic.
That's awesome. And I want to share I want to share my little story with you just so everybody knows. So when I got this whole thing started, I really wanted to do something in the magic space, and I put, I put my thinking cap on and I thought really hard for a while and coming up with all these ideas and stuff. And then I had this brilliant idea. I was like, oh my gosh, that's perfect. Next level magic. It like really incorporated what I wanted to do, taking people's game to the next level, stuff like that. And I don't know how I missed it, but I was sharing that with my brother and my friend. My friend did a search. He's like, hey, you know some guy, because he doesn't play magic. He's like, some guy wrote a book about that already. I'm like, what? Like I said, I don't know how I missed it. So sure enough, I find your book, and I reach out to Patrick, and I said, hey, I have this URL. Here's what I want to do. Basically, do you mind if I use it? And Patrick was really gracious. He came back. He said, hey, that URL wasn't available when I wrote the book, but since I do have the book and it's kind of my IP, I would like to use it type of deal. And I thought, hey, no problem. And I was more than happy to, give that URL to you. And like I said, Patrick was really gracious. He said, hey, I shared with him what I was kind of thinking of doing, and he said, hey, I like what you're doing, and if there's anything I can do to help out, let me know. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you kind of laid out a plan of how, of some of the magic, all the different stuff you want to do with magic media and with helping people get better at magic. And it's super awesome. The stuff that you're talking about, definitely super, super excited to see what all you do. And I definitely very much appreciate, looked at Next Level Magic, nextlevelmagic.com, which I'm going to be doing more stuff with in the future, but having that as a, obviously Next Level Magic was my first book.
Right,
it's super awesome, because before somebody was just sitting on it before, and I guess they let it lapse. And I very much appreciate you thinking of me and reaching out to me. And honestly, MTG Pro Tutor, I'm just excited to see what all you do with it. And it's an honor to be your first guest.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm super excited to go forward. So one question I have is, where does the innovator come from? Where does that nickname come from?
It's funny, because it's a question that I get asked a bunch that I think there's like a misunderstanding about a few. I don't know. I tell you what. How about this? When I first was writing articles for Star City, I signed my name a different way each week. Or not, it wasn't even week, because they weren't weekly articles. I had to write articles through the mail, and it was like a whole slow process for the turnaround. But each of my articles, I signed my name a different way. And it just so happened that one of the articles, I signed my name Patrick Chapin, the innovator. The next week, I actually signed, or the next article anyway, I signed my name a different way, because I was just signing my name a different way in every article, but people started calling me that.
Oh.
And it's funny, because some number of people are like, oh, did you give yourself your own nickname? And it's like, first of all, it's not even a nickname. I mean, did Jay-Z give himself his nickname? No, it's not a nickname. Right. It's just, it's a handle for writing. But
right.
In this spot, it actually accidentally, organically came up because of the fact that of the changing it each week, that was one that a bunch of people really started repeating. And once other people started repeating it, I just started using it anyway and just embraced it, because you could do a lot worse than, I've been called a lot worse,
Nice. Awesome. Cool.
But I think that the reason that it feels particularly appropriate is because of how much I value innovation and how much I make it a priority to think about how to innovate and how to actually select among innovations what will actually be useful. And it's just a very important part of the game for me.
That's awesome. And that's where I thought, it came from, was from your experience and ongoing practice of innovating every,
maybe new formats. Maybe that's why other people start repeating that one. I don't know.
Yeah, that's cool. So you talked about how you are a game designer and then professional magic player, and so those two are pretty close, hand in hand. Some people have other professional lives that aren't really related to magic at all. So I guess,
well, this is actually quite a bit different. I mean, I've been doing game design at various times for a very, very long time, but I mean, working for a video game company, it's not as similar to magic as you might think. There's some amount of overlap, to be sure, because people who are good at magic can definitely you know, they're above average, likely to be good at a few other areas. But this is very much this is definitely a different job that requires a different skill set.
So have you brought anything from your professional life into how you play Magic or vice versa?
Well, definitely brought a shortage of time compared to what it used to be like before I was working so much. But there's a lot to be learned about like team building and functioning as an organization. Okay. In Magic, it's very easy to operate as an individual, but I think that there's a lot of advantage to working as a team and working at a, you know, working at various game companies has helped me learn a lot more about team, you know, preparing as a team, working as a team, teamwork, team management, team, you know, how to cultivate a team, whatever.
Right. That's cool. That's really cool. Thank you. Patrick, you've had an amazing journey thus far playing Magic. And what we want to do here is we want to close the gap between where you are and where our listeners are. And the best way that I know how to do that is through stories. And so we want to hear a story about you from the early days of Magic. Like, I want to be right there over your shoulder. Tell us a story of an early challenge that you struggled with and then like how you overcame that challenge.
Well, one of the earliest challenges that I remember that was really, really important, I guess, was the battle, and this has been kind of a recurring thing, but the battle to try to convince people of how good I was. As a kid, I really had I had such a strong desire to try to prove to everybody, oh, I'm already really good. I have a lot of ego invested in this. I need to prove to you how good I am. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing that has reemerged at various times in some different incarnations without my even realizing it. And I think it's a very common thing for people to for people to encounter. And overcoming it wasn't as simple as a little epiphany where there's like a light switch and it's just different. It was more of a getting to a place of instead trying to prove to myself, and not even prove as in I'm already good enough, but instead of focusing on the proof side, just focus on improvement by seeking to be the best, the highest version of myself I can be, the absolute best. You know, like I envision myself the best possible way that I can think of, that I can believe in, and try to and move towards that as best I can. And all of the rest of the stuff falls into place over time. And trying to stay humble and focus on improving yourself, while at the same time not worrying about the fact that the more tournaments you go to, the more tournaments you play in, and the more that you interact with more people who don't really know you, there are going to be more times where people think things about you that are, or maybe they don't realize how good you are. Maybe they think you're annoying. Maybe they think you're a jerk. Maybe they think that you're anything about you. Maybe they think that you are, that you owe all your success to somebody else you worked with. Whatever they think about you, there's such an innate desire to want to try to convince people, no, I'm not a jerk. I'm a nice person. You should like me. No, I'm actually good. You should. And that's not actually, like, trying to convince people of these things is not as useful as improving yourself. Something that's a little bit easier of a quicker challenge than just the, you know, realizing that I wanted to focus on humility and self-improvement. Something that was a little bit more of a light switch flip over to a new position was at my first adult pro tour in Paris back in 97. You know, because I played in 96 in the junior division, but in early 97, I played in Pro Tour Paris, the first international Pro Tour. And it was, I had at the time a Bloom combo deck, Bloom Drain combo deck, which part of the significance, the historical significance to Magic of that was that before this particular combo deck, nobody had ever done well in major tournaments with combo decks. Okay. It used to be that the only decks that would ever do well were control decks, land destruction decks or aggressive decks. Combo decks would almost never, you know, once in a while there would be something, but for the most part, combo wasn't a very big part of the Pro Tour. This Pro Tour I had, I was one of the people who had the best version of the best combo deck, and it was going to revolutionize Magic. I actually was in the hotel room with Mike Long, who went on to win the tournament with this combo deck. I was in the hotel room testing and preparing with the Pro Tour winner the night before the tournament started. And I made a rookie mistake, a young kid mistake. Mike was already like competing at national tournaments before there was even a Pro Tour. He's been one of the greatest, he was one of the greatest deck builders and greatest minds in the game from year one of the Pro Tour, or before the Pro Tour, from year one of Magic. But in talking with him, I was super excited about how unbelievably good our build of the deck was. And later at a meeting, there was a player meeting where all the people in the Pro Tour were, back then they used to do a question and answer thing where people could ask the head judge questions to try to clarify, because the internet wasn't very big back then. Right. So asking the head judge rules questions would be very helpful to people to make sure that we're all on the same page with what the rules currently are. And somebody asked a question that they asked, can you cast Infernal Contract at zero life? And Infernal Contract is a card that requires you to pay half your life. And the reason this is significant is because at the time you could still play at zero life. You weren't dead until the end of the turn. But the only reason anybody, you weren't dead until the end of the phase. So wow. you could play your whole turn, build tons of mana at zero life. And then as long as you drain life to your opponent for like 30, you'd be fine.
Wow.
The only reason anybody would ask that question though, was that it was obvious to anybody at the event though, that people were asking that because of a reason. And so people would start asking, wait, why do people want to know about why you could, you know, can you Infernal Contract at zero life? And that was the missing link. There were a number of people who knew that Bloom Drain combo decks existed, but most people didn't realize how good they were because they didn't have the missing link. Infernal Contract was the missing link, and somebody effectively spoiled it, like gave everybody this technology the night before the tournament. And as a kid, I was only 16 at the time. I overreacted. I thought, oh my God, everybody's going to play Bloom combo decks and anti-Bloom decks. And what I didn't take into consideration was that, no, people are going to play the deck they brought.
Right.
And just because they have this new piece of technology, it doesn't mean they instantly understand the best way to apply this. And as a result, I gave up the best deck. I could have played the best deck. I gave it up.
Oh, no.
And I played a deck that was designed to do one thing, beat that deck. And then I went 2-5, because guess what? Not very many people played that deck.
Nobody played the deck.
Right. Some people did, but not very many, because most people at a tournament are going to play a huge variety of stuff.
Man.
So wow. The point is, you got to be real careful. It's super tempting for people to throw out all their testing the night before the tournament and overreact to a small piece of information they gain. Don't do it. You gotta believe in the testing. You gotta believe in the information that you have found. Don't panic and throw it out the window and do something crazy.
That's super interesting. Thank you. That's really cool. Yeah, because I'm just beginning to go to big tournaments myself, and so coming across that kind of information is definitely going to be helpful. But I guess some other quick background basic questions that I don't know the answers to. When did you start playing Magic? What's that?
Well, it was a little bit of a blur because it wasn't so much just straight up. I mean, I had my first cards that I actually played a whole bunch with, like Fallen Empires was one of the most recent sets, and the Dark, but, like Fallen Empires had just come out, but I was introduced to it before I had cards. It started with, my mom actually bought me a booster pack of Arabian Nights when she was at a hobby shop in Michigan to get me as a present in 93. But
what
then
a cool
she,
mom.
But she returned it because she found out, she gave it back because it didn't have a rule book. Arabian Nights is not enough to play. And it's like, oh, you need a whole bunch of this other thing to play. And they didn't have that because I think they were like sold out of beta at the time. And so my mom put it back. So I had this near brush with it, but I didn't know enough to even be experienced with it. Later, my cousin Matt and my best friend at the time, Jesse Roberts, the two of them introduced me to the game almost simultaneously, independently of each other. and started showing me some of their cards from like The Dark and from Revised. And then later that year, I got my own cards and dove in immediately. So I've been playing ever since 94.
There you go. Option of the races.
And I've been playing competitively since they had a Pro Tour back in 96. Or before that, I guess. But.
So what's been your favorite set and why?
My favorite set? That's a tricky one because it changes over time depending on your perspective. Because when I was a kid, I was really – like when I was early on in Magic, I was very innocent. Like there was you always remember some set from back in the day super fondly, but it doesn't necessarily play as well by today's standards because all the sets now are so much better designed than most of the sets from back in the day. I think everybody's first set really has a special place in their heart. And for me, Revised really stands out, although I like Beta better. But I think the best set that I've – Innistrad is probably the best design set. And okay. I really like Khans of Tarkir block.
Okay. Excellent. And you're right about that first set being being sweet. I came in during the Tempest storyline. So I loved, you know, like Gerard and Volrath and, you know, the sets Stronghold.
That's just a classic
and all those.
Anyway.
And that, I mean, that's when I came in. And so that's obviously, that's yeah. So cool. So now I don't want your favorite because I know that's really hard. So what's one of your favorite cards of all time?
Well, my number one favorite, Super.
Oh, you do have one. Great. What is it?
Jace the Mind Sculptor, better than all.
Okay. Excellent. So what makes Magic fun for you? Like, why have you kept playing all these years?
There are a lot of different dimensions that make Magic fun, but to distilling it down, there's first and foremost the people that I've met. So many amazing people from all over the world, so many different walks of life, and had so many great experiences with this culture where we have the shared language. But as far as the game itself, ever since I was shown Magic, I've never been bored ever again. There's always more to think about. There's so much proximal learning and so much being in flow, and it's this world that never ends. It's super awesome. What about you?
I love that, like you said, there's so many – I love that the game starts before you sit down. You know, I love that it's like this game – you know, games come in boxes with pieces and stuff like that. And this game has thousands of pieces that we call cards. And we get to pick, depending on the format that you're playing, you get to pick from all these thousands of pieces the cards that you want in your deck. And that's where the game starts. And then I sit down across the table from you and, you know, your pieces, your cards get to interact with mine. And we just get to see, it's a different game every time you play. You know, that's what I love about it.
Super cool.
What's your proudest Magic moment to date?
Proudest Magic moment. It's probably split between being inducted into the Magic Hall of Fame and being voted into the Magic Hall of Fame and winning Pro Tour Journey to Knicks.
Absolutely. I figured that would be it.
the being inducted into the Hall of Fame is sort of the lifetime. Like it's spread out over the course of my entire life, all of the things that led up to that moment. And there was that real validation of, you know, being honored in that way. It's very humbling and very powerful, and it has been the thing that has meant the most. And then on the competitive side, actually winning a Pro Tour, the other like in-game accomplishments pale in comparison to it, because there is nothing like actually winning. I mean, being first place is so different than second, and I can't tell you how painful it is to come in second at World Championships and coming in second at Pro Tours and second in Grand Prix. It's so... Second is the hardest sometimes, and I know that it's tough because that seems like, oh, aren't you so happy about that? And you are, but it is a different thing. Winning an actual Pro Tour, though, was even better than I ever dreamed.
Awesome.
It made the previous 21 years, the previous 20 years, all of it was worth it, if only for that. I could die the next day and be a happy man.
Awesome, man. And I know myself included and many others were very happy for you as well. So that's great. As we transition from your start as a Magic player to what you have going on today, I do want to touch, and we've talked about a little bit, on your rise, you know, to the upper tiers of the Magic community. How does someone make a name for themselves today, you know, in our Magic community? And are the things that you did, do they work today? And what's your perspective?
Sorry, you're talking about in terms of playing, or you're making a name for yourself?
Yeah, like being like getting noticed and moving up.
Well, getting noticed and moving up are very different things. Are you talking about moving up in the competitive scene, like in terms of like getting qualified for the Pro Tour, or winning winning an FNM or winning a regional PTQ, or
in GPs and Pro Tours, so that the Magic community at large kind of knows who you are.
Well, I guess then it depends. If your goal is actually for people to know who you are, I guess it really depends on what you want that to mean. There are a lot of crazy things that get you noticed where people know who you are, but that's not necessarily the same as
good point
as building a reputation for playing well. And I think focusing on getting, I mean, there are some people that, and this can totally be totally reasonable, but if your focus is on, for instance, if you're trying to make a bunch of music or do a bunch of card alters or promote tournaments or there are a number of things you might want to do that would put more weight on people noticing you. But if your goal is to win at Magic more and to be the best player you can be, focusing on people noticing you is actually a distracting side quest that can actually take away and impede your growth. If you focus on making yourself the best player you can be and focus on finding the best competition you can play with to prepare with, all of the rest of the stuff, you get noticed. If you are, no, but you can't do well at Magic. You can't continue to improve at Magic and not get noticed eventually. And it's much more powerful to not be trying to sell yourself to people, but instead just demonstrate what you can do on the merits, like produce results. If you can go from just getting into the tournament scene to transitioning to winning FNMs, to transitioning to making day two of a Grand Prix, to transitioning into cashing Grand Prix, into possibly even eventually qualifying for the Pro Tour. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people click on Wizards webpage and see the coverage and see all the people who made top eight of the Grand Prix.
Good point. Yeah.
But you can also just meet a bunch of people. The other side of it, because it is useful to meet more people, to have, you know, new experiences and to gain as much insight as you can. And key is be an awesome human being. Be reasonable to people. You know, if you're just, if you're just like a reasonable dude, if you're like, an easy guy or gal to get along with that is like fun to be around, the people come after you. They want to be around people who are fun, awesome people who like something they like.
Yeah, agreed. I've definitely seen that. I've experienced that, you know, people that have that gravitas, you just kind of want to be around them for sure. So, bringing things to present times, right now, what do you consider your best or your favorite format?
Standard, I'd say.
Okay.
Both in terms, I mean, among all the normal, you know, because still the 21-time Mental Magic World Champion, but in terms of actual, like, the normal format, Standard is my primary focus. It is both the one I enjoy working on the most and the one that I have the highest win percentage in.
So what are you playing in Standard right now, or do you switch it up, or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I play whatever, but, recently over the past, I guess 9 months, Abzan has been the deck I've played the most, but I've played I've played a variety of other things, and I certainly test everything, but Abzan control is the thing I've played the most. And I think if I were to play in a Standard tournament right now, it is very possible that I would play Abzan because I haven't been focusing on Standard. I've been focusing on Modern, and I would want to go with something I'm comfortable with, because I think Standard right now is very much a format that rewards people for playing strategies they're good with.
So that kind of leads into a follow-on thought that I had, or a question. So do you stick with one archetype the whole season for familiarity, or switch it up based on what's winning?
Well, no, I mean, I'll play anything. It's just that it's not so much based on what's winning. It's that if I have time to prepare, because I work you know, I have to work like 80 plus hours a week. If I sometimes will just not have very much time to prepare and will have to use a lot of shortcuts regarding how to get the best preparation I can with the time that I have available, and instead rely on conversations and 21 years of experience to try to get by. Other times I'll be in a spot where I can actually playtest a little. And if I can actually playtest and try out different decks, I will play anything. I just want whatever gives me the best chance to win. I mean, in a vacuum, I love playing control and would default to playing a control deck, like a blue-white control or blue-black control or something. But the reason I mentioned defaulting to Abzan or something like that is because I've been focusing on a different format where I've been spending my testing time preparing for Modern. It's better, if I'm going to play a standard tournament, to play something that I have that I have experience with. I think right. Too many people switch which deck they're playing over and over and over again just because they want to play whatever's hot right now. If you're literally a master of everything, you can definitely do that. But most people are not. Most people would be much better served to get comfortable with a deck. And if it's not working for them, feel free to switch. But you don't want to be switching every single week.
Right. Yeah, that, and you read my mind. I was going to say, my thought was, I guess it depends also on the player. Someone like you with lots of experience would have a much better chance, you know, switching to, you know, quote, more popular deck or whatever than someone like me who would probably benefit from, you know, playing what I practice, like you talked about earlier, as opposed to just switching to the hot thing. So,
well, and yeah. I benefit also from playing what I practice. I think that you have to weigh, though, how confident can you be that you will play something proficiently, mm-hmm. and somebody who has played every archetype many, 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 many times can have a higher degree of confidence in whether or not they will be able to play a deck at a satisfactory level of proficiency. If you haven't played 10,000 hours of Magic, you probably want to focus on a deck for a little bit, at least some amount of time. And the thing is, though, if you play in a tournament and you did not like it, don't force yourself to stay with it. Play something else. However, even if you lost, even if you went 0-3 drop, if you actually liked it, if you felt like you were getting better, if it was something that was appealing to you, stick with it, you know?
How long does it take for you to get that feel? Like, you know, first game, you're like, whoa, this deck is not my thing, or does it take...
Are you talking about for me personally or for an individual?
Because for you.
I've spent 30,000 hours of my life thinking about Magic. I can always look at a deck and know if it's for me or not.
Just by looking, you don't even have to play?
I can look at a deck.
That's awesome.
And as long as the math is there, I can't know whether or not it's the best. Whether or not it's the best, I generally need a huge amount of work. That is very, very, very difficult. But if a bunch of authorities that I trusted, a bunch of people that I thought were very, very good told me this is what they think is the best deck to play, I can look at it and know whether or not it is for me.
That's awesome. That's really cool. So something else that's current that I know you have going on are your books. Like, I know you're doing a signing coming up and things like that. So congrats on that.
Thanks.
I guess one thing, how come there's not more out there? Like, if you're the only one that I really know of that has, you know, hey, like here's Magic. We all love it. And here's a book that I wrote to kind of get some knowledge out there and help people improve. Like, why, in your opinion, why isn't there more of that out there?
Why don't more people write Magic books?
Yeah.
Good question. That's a subject very near and dear to my heart. I am very, very interested in seeing a lot more Magic books because I think that there is a huge amount of, there's so much more that can be said and done with Magic media, Magic teaching, Magic culture, Magic experiences, Magic stories, Magic anything, even in the casual creation, all sorts of stuff, Magic art. There's tons and tons of aspects of Magic culture. And I think that it very much is just the fact that we are, even though 21 years can seem like a long time, 22 years now, we are very much still in the infancy of what Magic is capable of and where Magic is going to go. And it is only relatively recently that people have even begun to see how much there is in Magic culture possible. I think a big part of it is just that the people who a lot of the people who could write a book about magic come from a background that isn't a book writing background. They are people who are playing in magic tournaments and stuff. You don't just, there isn't already a bunch of demand for magic books that has, there isn't already somebody who is making magic books with 100 different authors. And I think in the future, when more people learn how to even make books, because making books is not exactly a trivial thing. When more people learn how to actually do the whole thing, I think that it's going to, there's going to be more in the future. But I would love to see more magic books. I think that there should be there should be a lot more magic books than there are right now.
Cool. I agree.
Oh, and you mentioned, by the way, before jump in, Next Level Deck Building is the most recent book. Next Level Magic was the first one, as we alluded to earlier, but Next Level Deck Building is the one that actually this upcoming weekend, from the perspective of people listening, will be of last weekend. But last weekend we've been in Charlotte doing a book signing, so that was I'm sure it was super cool from time traveling perspective.
Exactly. So now, no one expects to win every time. That's a given. However, I personally know that it's frustrating to feel like you play and play and play and, you know, don't improve. So, you know, Pro Tutor listeners, myself included, they want to know, you know, how can they actually improve? So what I want is to ask, what is the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then what can we do to avoid that mistake?
Say the biggest mistake that I see people make is focusing their energy on convincing themselves and others that they are already good enough instead of seeking the truth and fearlessly seeking the truth and using that to make their game as good as possible. And that this manifests
how do they,
in so how
do
many
they,
ways.
Find the truth?
There's so, well, for instance, after each playtest session, heck, after each game, after each tournament, after each any amount of time in which you played some games of Magic, or after a specific single game, asking yourself what you can learn. You probably shouldn't do it between game one and two of a match in a tournament, but after the match, asking yourself, what can you learn from the match you just played? Because most people will be very focused on how unlucky their draw was. They'll focus on their opponent getting so lucky and top decking a card. They'll focus on how they didn't draw the card they wanted. They'll focus on all these things that are not the important thing. When they win, they focus on how great they are, you know, and what they instead could be doing is looking at the match and asking themselves, what could I have done better? What could I have done to give myself any amount of better chances to win? Because even if you played super well, your opponent played horrible, you got unbelievably unlucky to lose, was there literally anything you could have done in that match? Could you have not tapped your mana wrong and given yourself a tiny, tiny little percent chance better? Could you have better anticipated what your opponent could have in their deck? Could you have played slightly faster? Could you have had, could your deck have been built slightly differently? Could you have killed a different creature or not taken 2 points of damage? If you can't identify a mistake you made in each of your losses, not that change the outcome, because sometimes you can identify a mistake that literally cost you the match.
Right.
Sometimes you can't, though. Sometimes it's just, what could you have done to give yourself a tiny little bit better of chance? If you can't find a single thing that you could have done to give yourself a better chance in most of your matches, then you have definitely got to focus more on awareness and realizing what's even going on, because that is a sign that you are not, that you're missing what's really important. So focusing on what can you actually, like, what did you learn? If you have a notebook and you literally just record one thing you learned or that you could have done better or a mistake you made that you could do better in the future, literally anything, get one of those from most of your matches. There's occasionally going to be a match where you literally didn't get to do almost anything. And even then, you probably did something wrong, but it can be hard to see sometime. But over the course of, like, you should definitely have at least 8 things you can do better for every 10 matches you play.
That, everybody, you need to hit the rewind 30-second button a couple times and listen to that again, because there was a bunch of nuggets that Patrick just dropped that are really, really good. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. That's going to be really good. It's going to be really good. So, Patrick, I want to acknowledge you for all you've done so far in the multiverse. And the insights you've shared so far have been awesome. We've learned a ton so far already. And I'm super pumped to see what you have to say in the next section here. Patrick, let's have a discussion about the lifetime of a set and get your insights on, you know, the various stages. So the first one I just want to touch on briefly, because the other, you know, sections I think are more worth our while. But the first thing that happens with the set is the spoiler season. You know, new cards are coming out. Everyone's clamoring about what's good and what, you know, how it's going to change different formats, and everyone's getting pumped up. What do you do during the spoiler season? Is that, you know, a thing for you, or are you just kind of like, you know, it's a blip? Like, what's that like for you? And is there anything that we can take away from the spoiler season?
Oh yeah, spoiler season is awesome. Spoiler season is, every spoiler season is like Christmas. It's better than Christmas. It's like Christmas over and over and over again. It's glorious. That is like some of the only time more fun than spoiler season is the first couple weeks of a format before the Pro Tour, where I get to prepare for the event now that I have all the cards to work with. I love it so much, getting to build decks with new cards. I love it so much. That's some of my favorite Magic to play. And I love, as the new spoilers come, asking myself how I would use this card and how does this fit into the framework of the rest of the cards that I can play with in this format. I love it so much.
Awesome. Now, do you have, I know per format the evaluation is different, but is there something that you do during the evaluation that is consistent across the formats that maybe can help our listeners when they look at and evaluate cards?
Well, generally, I primarily focus on evaluation through the lens of standard.
Okay.
Because now,
let's talk about that then.
Yeah, but the reason I do that is because the number of cards in each new set that impact modern, legacy, or vintage is very small, and you don't have to spend as much time evaluating very many cards because the sets are designed for standard. Most of the now, Commander is a different thing. I think that if you play Commander a lot, all the cards are open to you again. That's a very, very different animal. It's just that I don't focus on Commander right now, but people who do, it's very similar to standard where you want to look at all the cards.
Great. Cool. All right, so we've evaluated the cards of a new set and have a pretty good idea what's good and what's not. And of course, well, we won't really know.
See that? Hold on, that's the first thing. One of the things, almost everybody focuses on trying to figure out what's good or not, and that's such a backwards way to do it. Because everybody in the future is just going to say whatever was winning is what is good. Huh. It doesn't matter what things people think are good or not good early on. And when everybody tries to guess what cards are good or not good, they end up closing their mind off to a lot of cards that could be useful to them. And they invest a bunch. They basically, good and not good becomes code for, I'm going to figure out how to use cards that are good, and I'm going to stop thinking about cards that are not good. And the problem with that is they miss so much technology because so many of the cards that are good don't look like they're good to people at first, because the designers intentionally make it so there are layers. They intentionally make it so that some of the cards are actually much better than people realize at first. Like, for instance, Jeskai Ascendancy, people did not fully understand how good it was at first. Treasure Cruise in Standard, people knew it was going to be good in Modern and Legacy and Vintage, but Treasure Cruise in Standard, people didn't fully appreciate. The point is, if you look at the card evaluation during spoiler season from the lens of how can I use this card, it's still fine to say, I think this is one of the best cards, or I think this card is, you know, this card might be good, or I think this card probably isn't good, or I think this card is definitely not good. The way to do that is, if a card is just strictly worse than a bunch of other cards, it doesn't do something novel, like a 7-mana 6/4, you can say, this is not in a category that I'm going to think about unless somebody else presents some compelling reason. But for the most part, most cards, you should make sure you understand what the use is for each card. That card, the use is that it's for limited. And for some cards, that's what the answer is going to be. But if you can look at the spoiler and ask yourself, why does this card exist? Come up with an answer. Sometimes the answer is it's for commander. Sometimes the answer is for drafting. Sometimes the answer is that it's supposed to trick people into wanting to use it, but it's actually not good. Sometimes the answer is that it's just really good against merfolk. Whatever. Make sure you understand a reason for every card existing. If you do that, you're already going to be ahead of 95% of people.
Why does this card exist? Awesome. Excellent. So, so then the first time that we get to play with cards is normally, you know, in a limited capacity, at a sealed pre-release or, you know, followed up by booster drafts, things like that. So sealed is generally considered to be a slower format with less powerful decks. And why is that? And how should we use that knowledge?
Compared to draft.
So why is that? And why should we, and how should we use that knowledge in our sealed deck building?
Well, so something that's important to note on sealed is that a lot of sealed formats are slower. However, they're often more powerful, even though they're slower. And the reason that they're more powerful often is that when you build a sealed deck, you have 6 booster packs worth of cards to build with. When you draft, you have only 3 booster packs. Now, in formats that don't have very much mana fixing, sometimes the sealed deck power ends up in the sideboard because too much of it ends up in the sideboard and the decks are much, much weaker because you're like, well, I didn't get to draft any amount of synergy. I can't use a lot of my good cards. My deck is just all over the place. However, in some formats, like for instance, just recently, Modern Masters 2015, there's tons of mana fixing. And there are some really powerful bombs. Because there are such powerful bombs and there's so much fixing, you can often splash all sorts of cards to help you. You can play with most of your best cards. And then when the bottleneck in the format is not synergy as much as power, sometimes a sealed deck can be very powerful. Now that said, Modern Masters 2015 is also a synergy-driven format where sometimes drafting the decks, even though you have less bombs, they can be much better than a sealed deck because they work together so well. And that's the reason why draft decks are usually faster, is because they're streamlined, where more of the cards work towards the same strategy.
Got it. So sealed could be less streamlined, but not necessarily less powerful.
Right. Sometimes is less powerful, but sometimes it's more powerful because sealed deck is almost always much more about bombs than draft is.
Okay.
Bombs being very powerful.
While drafting might be more about building those synergies.
Yeah, your cards working together matters more.
Sweet. So when you're drafting, do you have any tips for like how to remember what you pass? You know, online you can see it, or rather you can see what you've picked and stuff like that, but how do you remember what you've passed?
So you got to focus on what matters. You only have so much processing power, so much brain power. And a lot of people focus too much energy trying to remember what they passed when it's really not as – I mean, it's super helpful to know, but if you only have so much processing power, you usually are best spent spending that on yourself, on what you're doing. But you should remember key cards. Remember things – like instead of trying to remember everything you pass, remember the key cards. And the key cards would be what bombs did you pass?
Okay.
What sweepers did you pass? What cards that can change the course of a game by themselves? Those are the things to remember. And beyond that, you want to remember generally what colors do you think the person to your right is playing, based on what colors do you think the person to your left is playing based on what you're passing, and what colors do you think the person to your right is playing based on what they're passing you. You know, like for instance, you might not always know what colors they're playing, but you can often know what colors they're not playing. And remembering that information is useful. And that is better than trying to remember every single detail.
So it'll be like, the guy to my right is not playing red and black because I keep getting a whole bunch of red and black cards. Right. The guy to my left is not playing green because I'm not getting any green cards. So no, I'm not passing him any green cards. And so something like that.
Well, in that case, it's actually the person to your left. It's better to think of it in terms of, I think the person to my left is, there's probably people to my left drafting white because I've been passing so much good white.
Okay.
And that makes it so that you're more aware if you, for instance, in pack two, open a white card and you're like, well, I was already drafting red and green, but I opened this white card. Should I switch? And if you remember that you passed a ton of white to the people to your left, mm-hmm. and nobody, but you passed white to the people to your left, you're probably less likely to get white in pack two.
Right. Now that might be the only good white card you see in pack two.
Now, if it has one white mana symbol, that's a little different than if it has like two or three. Right. But that's a decision you just have to make based on what the opportunity cost is.
Gotcha. Sweet. All right. So the pre-release is over and we've drafted the set a little bit. Big magic events are usually the next thing for players. Many people go to large events once they feel they have their feet under them at their local game store, you know, F&M, things like that. So in order to prepare for these bigger events, I hear a lot about teams and playtesting. And so I want to talk about that a little bit. Like, do you have a team that you play with?
Yeah, I'm playing with Team Ultra Pro. I have a long history with Team Pantheon also, and they're very near and dear to my heart, very good friends of mine. But I'm also super excited. A bunch of my other friends, who a lot of them used to be on the Pantheon, we have a super awesome testing group, Team Ultra Pro, that includes Hall of Famers Ben Stark, Paul Rietzel, Bob Maher, and tons of other great deck builders and minds throughout the history of the game. And we prepare for Grand Prix and Pro Tours, both online in terms of like message groups and in practicing, like playing Magic online, and in person. And it's super awesome. Being a part of such a fantastic testing group is a super boon. But there is a little bit of a difference. Even though I think a lot of those things cross over, there are slightly different objectives when you're preparing for a Pro Tour versus when you're preparing for a Grand Prix or a pre-PTQ. And through all of them, though, one of the big constants is that your game can only improve as much as the people you play with.
Okay.
And if you're the best player in your playgroup, you got to make it your focus to get the other people in your playgroup better, or find a new playgroup. Because at the end of the day, if you want to get better, you got to prop the other people up around you and bring their game up, because that's the only way you're going to be able to push your game. And team organization doesn't have to always be straight up formalized, but it's very helpful if eventually you end up with some sort of a formal arrangement. But the way you get to that is by playing at your local game store with people and figuring out, who do you like talking with? Who do you like sharing ideas with? Who do you have a good time interacting with Magic? The other side of it is, you can also just, on Facebook, who do you have good conversations with? Sometimes just starting a Facebook thread with a couple people that you were talking with at the game store can lead to stuff more, you know, can lead to more conversations in which you guys all help bring each other's games up. The big thing, though, is to focus on generating value for the people around you and figuring out the stuff you want to figure out. People get too hung up on trying to make other people follow team protocols, like, okay, let's have dues and have meeting times, and we're going to have a newsletter, and everybody gets a tattoo with our name on it. And it's like very, very, very ahead of where you need to be when you're first
formalized.
Right. Yeah. You got to figure out first, just have good conversations and just share ideas. And remember, though, that you want to focus on learning the things you want to learn and being helpful to other people in the way that they want help. It's very tempting for people to try to force other people to learn the things they want to put on them instead of the things the other person wants to hear. And in a team situation, it's not the same. Like, for instance, somebody who wants to read an article on Star City Games, somebody who's coming to who's reading a book on magic or coming to a podcast about magic, that is a different dynamic. They want to hear whatever the authority has to teach them. But when you're forming a team, everybody on the team is helping everybody else on the team. So you want to help other people the way they want help, and you want to try to find the answers to the problems you're looking for answers to.
Excellent. More nuggets. Help people how they want to be helped. I like that. So how do you prepare for an event, Patrick? What does it look like? Does it look like taking the week off and sitting in a like hotel room with your buddies, like you were saying, and just kind of practicing like you did way back in the day? Or what does it look like for you now?
Well, back in the day, I used to just play Magic all the time. Right now, I think about Magic all the time, like tons, but I don't get to play all the time because of just how much other stuff I'm doing. However, I communicate in a Facebook group and have lots of email correspondence and phone conversations with teammates, and we do Skype calls, and I play games on various various ways to play Magic online. Right. And I also meet up in person because the 2 weeks before a pro tour, I take off of work and go meet up with teammates, and we prepare in person. We'll be playing Magic, most all day long every day, and alternating between both draft and constructed. But even long before those 2 weeks, I am building decks all the time and thinking about Magic all the time and trying to absorb the wisdom of people around me, because I am blessed to have such a great bunch of people around that actually do have more of the time to play Magic a whole bunch. And it's not like some exclusive monopoly where the only way I get to hear what Sam Black is talking about, what Adrian Sullivan is talking about, is from conversations with them. They write articles. There are a ton of amazing, there's all kinds of Hall of Famers and Platinum players writing Magic articles, giving you their thoughts, and reading that Magic material and thinking about it. What does it mean to you? What are your take on it? What is your take on it? Because sometimes people will say mutually exclusive things. The important thing is not so much to imagine that everything everybody says is just gospel, but instead, why do they think that? Why is that their view? And understanding what they have to teach you and trying to learn stuff from each of these different sources. Whoever it is that teaches you, whoever it is that you listen to, read, talk with, interact with in any capacity who teaches you something, try to learn whatever it is that they're willing to teach you, whatever they want to say, whatever they want to teach you, and use that as best you can. And to me, that's a big part of my preparation.
Awesome. Excellent. Well, we have just a few minutes left here, and so I want to bring things down for those entry level players, those people who, they have a limited budget and they can't afford to draft every day on online or construct a new deck in whatever format. What do you suggest for those entry level players? What can they do to improve and really kind of get their hands on and experience the game and get better?
Well, remember, there are a lot of aspects to Magic and what it means to improve. You can improve your ability to win at Magic in different formats. You can improve your experience at a tournament, how much fun you have. You can improve your play group, like how many people you play with, and find more and super awesome people to play with. You can improve your collection through trading and or winning or whatever. You can improve your deck building by practicing and building a variety of different decks. The key is to figure out whatever it is that you're enjoying, whatever it is you care about, whatever it is you want to get better at, and looking at what you can do instead of focusing on what you can't do. If you want to build decks with the cards you have. If you want to improve your collection, trade some cards. If you want to learn more about Magic strategy, read more articles. If you want to get better at winning games of Magic, practice more games with whatever you have. And there are many, many things you can do. Like, for instance, holding on to a draft deck after you finished it can be a great way to, or a sealed pool. After you build a sealed pool, if you keep it together, maybe take out the rares or whatever for your collection and then replace them with a proxy of the rare, like write the word of the rare in, but you can reuse those pools in the future, and you can like other people you prepare with, you can mix and match and try building decks out of other people's pools.
Absolutely.
And you can take cards that you've already drafted with and redraft out of them. You can use simulator programs. You can draft with other people's cards in some situation where, for instance, at a game store, they might want to open up cards, and you'd be willing to open up cards if you can just build a few decks and then give their cards back to the person, but just build a few decks out of their cards and then open and sort it, because a lot of stores will want their cards sorted. There's a lot of creative solutions you can do, but just figure out what you enjoy, what you want to get better at, what you're passionate about, and then look at what options. Be imaginative. Think outside the box. Think of anything you could possibly do, even if it sounds crazy.
I like it. So, Patrick, do you have any Magic-related resources you'd like to share with our listeners?
Highly, highly recommend StarCityGames.com. It has both a free side and a premium side that's a paid side. And all the premium side stuff after a month you can read anyway. So you can go back and look and absorb tons and tons of knowledge there. And then Next Level Magic and Next Level Deck Building are two resources that I recommend for people who want a bigger investment, that if they're serious, because you only have to win one Friday Night Magic to recoup such an investment. But it is a bigger involved investment that also, I mean, it's an entire textbook. There's a lot of material there. And then there's also toplevelpodcast.com. Just tune in for free and you can hear Michael J. Flores, who's one of the godfathers of magic strategy at all, who invented – you know, he's the author of Who's the Beatdown. You can him and I do a podcast every week that you can tune into.
Excellent. So, Patrick, do you have any, or rather, what are your plans for the future? Do you have any machinations of grandeur for upcoming Pro Tours?
For upcoming Pro Tours, I mean, I'm going to go to them all. I have my sights set on winning the World Championship. That is the next goal. It's going to all. Everything else is just a means to an end. Winning the World Championships is the next goal. And last year I lost in the finals for the second time. I'm going to redouble my efforts. And one way, it's very, very tough to get a slot at the World Championships these days, particularly if you don't go to Grand Prix, but that's my focus.
Okay. So finally, what's the best way to connect with you? And then what's one parting piece of guidance that you can share with our listeners?
You can connect with me at Twitter, the P. Chapin on Twitter. And I also have a public figure page on Facebook, Patrick Chapin the Innovator. But Twitter is definitely a great way to reach me. And parting piece of information is to make sure you're enjoying it. Magic is such an awesome thing. There's so much love in it. And it can be very frustrating at times. And then sometimes you can want to improve so badly that you can temporarily lose sight of what was making it fun for you in the first place. You have to love it. You have to be enjoying it. And if you ever find yourself not having fun, then that is a good indicator that you should change up your approach a little bit and try something a little bit differently. Because above all else, magic has to be fun. And that is actually the best way to improve.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Patrick, for your time and for sharing your expertise. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed, always draw what you need, and depart every plane victorious.
Thanks for having me.
All right, there you have it. Episode 298 is all wrapped up, all ready to go. Patrick Chapin, the best of episode, is all done. We got to learn about him and his past and how he got into magic, and what a great show. So thank you again for your patience in dealing with me. Thank you again for letting me sneak away for a couple weeks. Thank you again for tuning in. Thank you to the patrons who make this all possible. Without you, I would not be able to make this show. And if you want to become a patron and you're not already, you can go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon. One of the cool perks is that each and every month we do a patron exclusive giveaway, and that prize is provided by Paragon City Games, who is the proud sponsor of this show. So we will be doing the July giveaway as soon as I get back next week. I'll be announcing the winner. So thank you again for your patience on that. Stay tuned to figure out if you are a winner. Huh? And when I get back, we're also going to be kicking off the M19 Prodigy Sealed League. I can't wait to play some magic with you guys. It's always, always fun. I love doing that. So stay tuned for more info on that. Well, best of luck to you all. Take care. Thank you so much for tuning in. Love you all. Until next time, I'm Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery, be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.